And with that, I'd like to introduce Al Jay from Buckingham.
Yes.
Hey. Al, alcoholic.
Hey.
That was short readings. I was ready for how it works and the traditions and all those things we generally read. It's kind of like our meeting. Well, I am an alcoholic, and I live in Buckingham County. If you don't know where that is, it's across the bridge from Scottsville, and it has a town that everybody goes, "Where is that?" It's called Dillwyn. Go figure. I have a home group there. I remain active in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is May 5th, 1987. That's because Alcoholics Anonymous works. I have not tried anything else, nor have I needed anything else. AA seems to do the trick for me. I have a sponsor, and I'm very involved in the primary purpose, to try to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. When I remain in those practices, and I believe that they're spiritual practices, it seems to me that God intervenes in the rest and takes care of the things that I don't think that He can take care of and that I ought to take care of, and I ought to get busy in attending to it, because if I don't attend to it, who will? But every time when I'm more involved in my primary purpose other than me, it seems to be the things that I'm worried about, the things that I'm scared about, they seem to take care of themselves. And with what's going on in society today, most of us have had some fears and doubts. And I have to remind myself and the guys I sponsor that God is not dependent on economy. Only my fear is. And the more actions I take in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I dive into this thing head first, it seems to me those things that I was concerned about yesterday and those things that I was worried about and those things that I was afraid of seem to take care of themselves. Someday, somehow, some way. Generally speaking, it's not on my timetable, because my timetable, I kind of like now. Sometimes it's been a while. But if I will be patient and do the things I'm supposed to do here and follow your suggestions, because they were not my suggestions, I'm doing pretty good today. Okay, I haven't had a drink or needed a drink almost since May 5th, 1987. Okay, that's pretty good. That's because my attitude changed. And my attitude was that when I came here, I listened to what you had to say, and I said, "I'm willing to do it," and I did it. My attitude changed. I did not fight it. I did not debate it. I did not argue it. I did not tell you I couldn't do it. I didn't tell you I had a job. I was busy. I found a way to do the things that you asked me to do no matter what, and it saved my life, and I didn't even know at the time it was saving my life. I had to have an attitude change. I had to. I had to surrender to the suggestions here. Because as long as I was in conflict or debating and arguing and trying to figure it out intellectually, will it work for me, will it not, didn't do me no good. As soon as I take it, I start getting better. Sometimes it takes a while for my brain to catch up with it. This is not an intellectual process. And I think, like Bill said, that the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. Okay, and this mind that God gave us is, it's mind-blowing the things that it's invented when you think about it. Okay, a TV set that we take for granted. Okay, a DVD that you watch a movie on. A spaceship that goes to a planet. Okay. Breaking an atom and developing nuclear energy. Bringing chemistry out of nature and understanding it. Cell division, DNA, clouds and where they come from, the ocean and the sprinkling of the rain. And all the things that the mind, I believe God gave us individuals to come up with those. That's my own belief. Inherently planted it in us. And it's just so magnificent, but when it comes to the 12 steps on the wall, it's like a Waterloo. It's like an intellectual trap. You know, here's this wonderful, beautiful mind that can create mathematics, and when it gets to step two, it starts scratching its head. Hmm. You know, and I think God has a lot of fun, to tell you the truth. He develops things that entertain him. You know, here he gives us this magnificent solution, and we will dissect it and analyze it and tear it apart at the shreds to try to figure out so it makes sense to me before I do it. In an AA, after a while, when you get old here, you just say, good luck. You know, that's what I tell guys now. Well, I don't think I'm going to do those steps yet. I'm going to wait till I get better. Good luck. I don't need as many meetings as you. Good luck. I haven't found the right sponsor. Good luck. I don't have all that time and energy to help out other people. Good luck. We just watch. That's what I tell people. What do you think about that? I said, don't worry about it. Just watch. You know, just watch. And that's what I do. You know, just watch. You know, I was a kid that early on was planted in me was this with Bill Wilson, where I started identifying so much in his story. And I want to talk a little bit about the big book tonight. I don't mean to turn anybody off, but so, sometimes we do, you know, because, you know, it's such a funny thing that I'll go to these meetings repeatedly for years, and then the other day the guy comes up that always comes up after years of sitting in meetings and goes, you know, I really didn't like you for a long time. He goes, you are a fanatic. He said, it was distasteful. He says, I don't know if you changed or I changed, but I understand what you're saying now. And you know, when you have passion here and you really believe in a cause, you are going to get criticized, and it's okay. You know, it's okay. We do that in AA, and we do it to each other, and in that criticism sometimes there's change, and there's change for the better. So don't be afraid of that. And Bill's story, he talks about early on having the drive of success, that he would prove to the world that he was important. And I remember early on, and I think that's probably AA's way, when we boil it down in a simpler way, that we're egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. And I really do believe at an early age, that described me to the T. That here I am, this little kid that's inadequate inside, but there's a raging ego. And there's this drive for success to prove to the world that I was important. You know, I didn't even know what that was all totally about until I got older. You know, that I was driven for that. And when I'd sit in the county jail from time to time, I'd scratch my head. Hey, Billy, could you get my water, please? I think it's over there, is it not? I wonder, how could I possibly get here? I don't belong here. And the sad fact is I do belong there because I broke the law, all right? But I would sit in jail and say, I don't really belong here. And I did. And I seemed to be a failure about every turn in my life early on. And I wasn't very good at school because I rebelled against it. I wasn't very good at authority because I rebelled against it. And I wasn't very good at sports because I didn't like the organization. I just really wasn't really good with a lot of things. And if I was the best at anything, it would be being bad. You know, so I acted out. And I acted out enough to get in trouble. And by the time I was 13 years old, I was down by the Chesapeake Bay in southern Maryland. And these two girls said, let's go up behind the liquor store and get the bums, as we called them, to buy us some Boone's Farm. nobody's heard of that here, okay? 13 years old, so we got some Boone's Farm and we tried it on. We took a swallow and then another swallow, and before we knew it, within a short period of time, shorter than needed to be, both bottles that I recall were gone between four people. Now, being at a young age of 13 years old, my body was not accustomed to that, so I certainly, after I got the effect produced by it that I actually enjoyed, I also had a consequence, which I puked all over my clothes. Got found out by my parents, got put on restriction, and got in trouble. That seemed to be the story of my whole progression. That every time I got in trouble, there was alcohol or drugs in my body. But I often have said lately that on the inside of the label of the Boone's Farm as you're drinking, it should say, warning, if you are age 13 and you drink a whole bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, You may be a future member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that when that stuff hit my brain the first time, I was in the grips of a progressive illness that always gets worse and never gets better, but I didn't know that. But I believe the progression started the first time. It just took a while to catch up. Because I have a progressive illness, and the progression is that it always gets worse, it never gets better, but my mind is consistently trying to convince me it's getting better while it's getting worse. And that's our insanity. And our book is very loud about that. It says that's the crux of the problem. Before we get to selfishness and self-centeredness and start treating that through the steps, it says the crux here is the insanity of our drinking. It's the insanity of the first drink. It's not in psychiatric insanity in Alcoholics Anonymous, though some of us probably were a good fit for psychiatric insanity. I have met some, have claimed they were. I know some of my friends in California. I know why they were in the nut house, okay? No doubt about it. But the book's very plain that we're not going to get all over the place in what insanity is, what it isn't. You know, do I have this emotional or this? It says, no, it's the insanity of the first drink. That means I can come to AA, come to a meeting, memorize how it works, get drunk. I can come to AA for a while and get drunk. If I don't take care of this problem of insanity within my brain, which is my relationship with alcohol, and it doesn't get removed by the 12 steps, I'm in trouble. Now, what the doctor called for, and the doctor's opinion is a very, very important appendix in the big book. Very important. It took me many years to understand its importance, so if you're slow, don't worry about it. I was very slow too. Okay? But one of the things it calls for right out is that we must have a message of depth and weight. Okay? Now, we have 115,000 meetings out there, plus multiplying all the time. That was like a year ago. God knows now it could be 125,000 meetings throughout the world. Does each meeting that we sit in carry a message of depth and weight? Because it says that we have to have a message of depth and weight that will hold these people and interest them. So if we're not holding people and interesting them, we may not be carrying a message of depth and weight. So as a fellowship, we have to look at ourselves. Hey, just don't drink is not a message of depth and weight. It's something you should do if you're an alcoholic, you want to recover, but it's not the message of depth and weight. Don't drink and go to meetings. What my psychiatrist said. If you have a psychiatrist, I'm not in conflict, but it's not a message of depth and weight. In fact, the doctor went on to say that you and I, in order to recover from this insanity of the mind, are going to have an entire psychic change. Okay? In fact, on one page it mentioned it three times. That's how important it is. And it says no human power could produce this entire psychic change. That means psychiatrist, my treatment center, my counselor, my mother, my father, my wife, my sponsor, my home group, none of those can produce it. Now, psychic change is an intellectual's way of talking about a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And that's the result of them. That if I will take the steps, unfettered by my own arguments and my own debates, and kind of cash in and surrender to the process, I will have the insanity in my brain that causes the first drink eliminated so I don't get drunk again. That's AA 101 simplicity. Okay? Now, as a young kid, I didn't know anything about that. The next thing I drank was screwdriver. Now, screwdriver is orange juice and vodka. I remember drinking it again. I got the quart. I drank the whole thing down and I threw it back up. I hadn't learned yet. And after that, I never drank a screwdriver again. And I remember I didn't drink much Boone's Farm after that. Okay. Now, back then, the legal age was 18. And I had a lot of problems. And I was sent away. I dropped out of high school. When everybody says, did you go to your high school reunion? I said, no, I was a dropout. I said, did you go to your college reunion? I said, no, I was a dropout. I was an alcoholic. I dropped out of a lot of things. So I'm 18 years old. I'm legal in Southern Maryland. And what I started drinking along with my non-habit-forming marijuana was Michelob ponies. You know? And I did like my beer. I never went back to wine or liquor too much. Occasionally I had Bacardi 151 or Peppermint Schnapps. But generally speaking, I was a Budweiser tall neck, graduated from the Michelobes to the tall necks, a little bit of relationship with Miller High Life, didn't really like that, and then I got to what ruined my life and destroyed it was Heineken beer. Okay? And Heineken beer put me right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love my Heineken beer. It took me about 8 or 10 to get where I was going, and I got there. I got arrested 11 times. And every time I got drunk, I did not get arrested, but every time I got arrested, I was drunk. And it just so goes that, you know, since I've been in AA, I haven't been arrested. Can you imagine that? You know, no probation, no nothing. You know, no judge telling me what to do, nothing. No ASAP programs, nothing. You know, free and clear. So I think about it, after about age 21, my drinking really became, I became a daily drinker. Went to college for 5 years. I did end up getting my degree in sobriety, but I didn't get it when I was drunk. And I mean, I just got awful drunk. I got to the point that the not yets that I'd heard in the ASAP program started coming true. Like I'd hear, you know, I drink in the morning. I thought, that's pitiful. I ended up drinking in the morning. And if I didn't drink in the morning, it's because I had to go to work, but I really wanted to drink in the morning, you know. And I got to the point for me that, you know, I had liked the narcotics. I had liked the marijuana. I had liked the ecstasy. I'd liked the LSD. I'd liked various other drugs. But I was able to give all of that up under my drinking on my own. Sometimes with a little bit of hardship, but eventually I was able to give up the drugs, separate myself from the bong hits in the morning and all the things that I did. But the thing that I could not kick out was the alcohol. I could not, for some reason, you know. The marijuana made me stupid. The ecstasy made me retarded. You know, the LSD made me insane. But the alcohol, and people say it stopped working. The problem with this idea that it stopped working, there may be some truth to that. The only problem is I couldn't get my mind to remember that, you know. And somewhere in the back of my mind today, the animal's in the cage, but the cage ain't locked. That it still remembers the magnificent feeling that comes with 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 drinks. Somewhere deep. That's why when you're dreaming sometimes, you're drunk in that drunk dream. People go, oh my God, how'd I have that dream? You're alcoholic. Non-alcoholics don't, so don't worry about it. When you're sitting and going through the day, sometimes it pops in your mind, wouldn't it be nice to go out and have a drink or a drunk tonight? It's just a fleeting thought. It doesn't turn into insanity because I've been treated by the 12 steps here. I've been treated by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and this higher power you've given me. I don't drink even if I want to. That's a promise in the big book. If someone drinks against their will, they haven't been restored to sanity. The idea of being restored to sanity is I don't drink now even if I want to. You know, that's one of the gems in these promises and these steps. And I go to an awful lot of meetings. And I got to tell you, there's a lot of confusion about our steps. You know, how simple they are, you know, and that we have specific directions in our big book. The other day I was sitting in a meeting and someone says, well, I don't know how to do the 11th step. We don't have directions in AA to these steps. And I thought, oh, yes, we do. In fact, when it starts the 11th step, it says we have some definite and valuable suggestions. And I think that's true for every step. Bill just put that in the 11th step. But we have some definite and valuable suggestions. Now, why do I beat the drum of specific directions? Because it helps us get focused in what we're supposed to do here, how to take the steps, and how to help the newcomer take the steps. I remember a time that before I got into the big book with the help from a lot of folks, I kind of wandered around in AA. I took the steps off the wall. I had an off-the-wall program. I didn't know quite how to explain it to the newcomer, you know. It was kind of jibber-jabbish, you know. It was, you know, there was no depth or weight behind it. It was just kind of my experience or intellectual experience, you know. Hey, this is what I think. And when I started to get grounded in the big book and the specific directions in there and had applied those to my life, not just an intellectual memory of it, it seemed to me that the message to the newcomer became crystal clear of how to take these steps and have a psychic change or a spiritual awakening. I think it's very important to know what our steps are. And they did leave it in a book. And you know, I'm not a guy that's really a book guy, to tell you the truth. My wife reads books all the time. Novels after novels after novels. She always accuses me. She says, "You never read anything." Well, I read my stuff on the internet. I'm not much of a book guy, and it baffles me why this book to me just is enlightening to me. And the more that I've read it over the years, and the more I've comprehended it, and the more that I just stay involved in it, it's an ever-changing book too. What you thought you knew last year about it isn't what you see this year. What you read 5 years ago isn't necessarily what you're seeing now. This book changes. It's a brilliant piece of literature. We in AA that have been here for a while, have gone through steps, do believe that God touched this book. We don't believe that a guy 3 years sober was capable of writing a book. And when you start getting into we agnostics and some of these promises attached to these steps, there's just, how would you possibly know that yet? You know, at 3 years sober, you're just now starting to let go of the chair, you know. And here's this guy writing this thing that's changed. Whoa, how many people? I mean, look at how many copies has been sold of this. Somebody told me that, and you'll have to correct me if you're in service, but they spoke at a group and said that 10 million copies of the fourth edition had already been sold on this. 10 million copies. I mean, somebody's eating this stuff up, okay? Sometimes I wonder if it's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Because we do. We have a concrete way to get sober and recover from alcoholism. So I blew my life pretty good, lost jobs, gained jobs, you know. Found myself walking through the doors of AA for the last time when I was 27 and a half years old. I'm almost 52 now, so I spent almost half my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been here a lot longer than I drank or used drugs. And I walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous full of treatment center. Everybody had been to treatment. Everybody had been to aftercare. Most of your meetings was treatment center alumni. And our message really within that had really got garbled and really had become what we call later on the word of mouth message of Alcoholics Anonymous, from this person to this person, from this counselor to that counselor. And the clarity in our message just didn't really survive yet. Because we were bringing in a lot of outside stuff that didn't belong in AA, but because people came from the outside and became AA members, we really thought that was Alcoholics Anonymous when it wasn't. And unfortunately, and you can say, well, what's he talking about? Well, most of those people that are sitting in meetings with me aren't here today. So the word of mouth program doesn't work. Okay. And so what I did is I fumbled around for about 2 years, and I finally bumped into, for my fortune, what I would call and describe today, though at the time I didn't know that, was what I would say is an AA sponsor. He was a benevolent dictator, okay? And it's exactly what I needed, okay? Because I was intimidated by him. I was intimidated enough that I did not argue with him. Not sure that I wanted to, okay? And he said things to me that weren't in the big book. I came in, and this isn't for you, so don't worry about it. This happened to me. He said, I came in with a big red beard, probably be gray today. He said, shave that off. He said, let the world see you. Now, you know, in AA, he'll say, where's that in the big book? What I said to him was, okay. Okay. Now, I don't know if he's right or wrong, so don't worry about it, okay? But for me, I did it. And it didn't matter if that was a right or wrong action. What mattered is I surrendered to his judgment and I did something that I probably wouldn't have done for my father. Now, I lived in Maryland. He lived in Georgia. After about 3 or 4 months of a relationship where he wasn't sure if he was going to sponsor me yet, he asked me to come down to Albany, Georgia. He said, two folks from Arkansas named Joe and Charlie are putting on the steps. He says, I think they're the best thing going in AA on the steps. We can really use it. I want you to come down and listen to them. Again, I didn't say, no, I can't come down. I don't have money. I work real hard. That's a bit far. How could I possibly get there? I said, yes. And I drove all the way down to Albany, Georgia. And I listened to men that changed my life. They had a profound effect on my life. Because after I heard them do the steps in 18 hours and the directions out of the big book, I came back and I was on fire, and I've been on fire ever since. Something happened in Albany, Georgia that had not happened by sitting 2 years in meetings listening to treatment center stuff. That when I heard Alcoholics Anonymous with a message of depth and weight, it had an impact on me that many, many years later still has an impact. That's what a message of depth and weight does. And I took that message, and not knowing how to carry it yet, I probably alienated a lot of people. And I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not what you say, it's how you say it that's effective. We can say two different people and say the same thing. One can alienate and one can draw. And so what I learned how to, what I needed to learn how to do was how to carry that message so it brought people to you rather than alienated them. And how I first brought the message is, you're wrong and I'm right. And that never works in AA or anywhere else. Okay? It doesn't work. In fact, a message of depth and weight is not wrong or right. It has depth and weight, and if you take it, it'll become right for you. It's just like the musts in the big book. There's a lot of them. Okay? Those musts aren't for me to tell you. Those musts are for me. And I got to remember that. And I don't even know what musts are anymore because I just do them. And I've done them imperfectly. So I took the steps, I got the change, I got the insanity removed from my brain. Okay, I'm not in danger of taking a drink even if I want to now. Okay, I'm going to a lot of meetings, I've got a sponsor now. And now you know what I'm starting to come eyeball to eyeball, head to toe with? Is my defects of character. And they're raging. Okay, and they are, you know, and when you look at the 12 and 12, Bill from about the fourth step on is talking nothing about character defects. That's all he's talking about anymore is character defects. And I, you know, I wasn't even familiar with it yet other than it was in the step. I knew it was in the step. I didn't know how much it was in me. You know, I didn't know I was in the grips of a broken bubble machine that kept producing bubbles in my brain, you know, all the time, you know, inappropriate, this, that, you know, what. You know, shut up! You know? If you could douse it out, you would. Break the bubble. You know? But the bubbles keep coming. What AA taught me about bubbles are two things. One, I don't have to jump on every bubble that comes in my brain. And number two, I don't have to act out every bubble I got. Just let the bubble go. So I got this financial problem. And it's eating me for lunch and spitting me out. I mean, I'm about 4.5 years sober now. And I am... I'm not saying my life was pretty good in some ways. In other ways, I was very self-obsessed. You know, that's how it usually is. It's not like every part of your life is. You know, I was going up the ladder in my business. They kept promoting me. And I was $28,000 in debt. I had a poor relationship with money. It was immature, about what a five-year-old would have. I'd thrown an inventory or two at it. I'd gone to a lot of meetings. I'd asked God to remove it from me. I'd done the AA suggestions on it, and it seemed to me that I was spending more money. And so finally, out of my own fear of being embarrassed by telling my sponsor, you know, I did finally tell him, you know, and I was embarrassed by it because he was very good with money. I told him I had a problem with spending money, and I wasn't sure what I could do about it. And I asked him, and there was a little bit of silence there, and then he came out with one of the most profound ideas that has hit my life up to that point, and I've used it many times on other character defects. He said, why don't you keep spending money? And he was exactly right. The old Eagles song probably summed it up, take it to the limit, all right? And I think with character defects, sometimes it's not a process of working on them because there's not much fruit bore in that. It's taking it to the limit till you can't stand it anymore, till you're burned out from it, that you're tired of talking about it, that you're, and all of a sudden there's a relief. And God removes or diminishes that defect. And when that happened to me at that time, probably about a couple years after that, by the time I was 13 years sober, I was out of all financial debt from the past and the present. I've not got back into debt other than buying a house. And soon I hope I'm out of that one. That's how it's been for me. Now, you can take that defect of character in a lot of different ways. There's envy, there's jealousy, there's pride, there's all sorts of stuff. There's self-obsession is what it is, and self-obsession knows no boundaries. Okay? Take it to the limit. And in that point that you get of desperation, God, I believe, will help you. On the other hand, while you're in it, I don't believe you're any less effective in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's not up to me who God picks to carry the message. I've seen some people in here, I wonder what kind of message are they carrying, and they're helping out people, so it's not my business. You know, Bill Wilson, was he not full of defects of character? People at my sponsor, my grand sponsor, my first sponsor, I can't think of a person in AA, once you get close to them, does not expose some part of a personality that's defective. God uses defectiveness to be able to capture somebody else, help them through the steps and recover from alcoholism. In AA, we don't know who's capable of helping who. We don't know if it's the brand newcomer one day that gets to you or me that has this length of sobriety. We don't know. I was sitting in a meeting in Charlottesville, and this guy that to me sounds off the wall. I don't even know what he's talking about half the time. So I'm sitting there in my judgmental machine. I don't know if you have one. I got one. Turns on about every hour. I'm thinking, what could that guy possibly be talking about? So we're standing up for the Lord's Prayer, and this lady behind me goes, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Hey, God! You know? So, those are those moments that I just keep my trap shut now, you know? How do I know? You know? I find there's more stress in my life and unhappiness when I fall into micromanaging AA or my personal life than when I don't. There's a line in the big book that's very powerful. It says, we had to quit playing God. You know why? It didn't work. And then we think, oh, well, we've done that. And then we look at the 11-7, it says, we constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. So we didn't get that good in that line yet. All right? There's no perfection in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, all the years I've read the big book, two things that it seems to exclude that are very much a part of my personality is perfection and rigidity. Okay? Can't find it in there, you know? It says no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence. We're not saints. The point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. Now, my confusion when I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, either brand new or many years later, is I start to feel like this is an emotional problem. Because it feels like one. It feels like anger. It feels like fear. It feels like sex. It feels like money. It feels like self-obsession. It feels like it. So I think it's an emotional problem. But it's not. Our program claims that it is a spiritual problem with emotional symptoms. And whenever I try to treat a problem that I think's the root, if it's emotional, but it's really spiritual, then the emotional problem gets worse. Because symptoms get worse when you treat them. When you treat the heartbeat of the problem, which is spiritual, the symptoms start diminishing. See, this isn't about becoming spiritual. You've seen that, haven't you? You get brand new in the first five, you're going to, God, you know, I need the pipeline. I get every spiritual book known to mankind, and I read it. I get to be an expert in my own head on God. And see, what I'm doing really is I'm on another self-centered course because I'm trying to fix me through the knowledge of God or the closeness. And I think that AA is saying, hey, you got to become spiritual. And then we read our book and it says, you already are. It was born in you. And what you see in the big book that goes hand in hand with spirituality is a word I never had in my vocabulary nor ever tried before I got to AA. And that's the word useful. And our program claims if I'm useful, I'll grow spiritually. I thought if I got spiritual, I'd grow spiritually. See, that's how the broken bubble machine confuses me. It throws me off track. And I go to meetings with other broken bubble machines and they validate what I already thought. You know? If you're trying to become spiritual, it'd be like having smoke coming out of your ears. If you could see it, you just never get quite to that point. You know? I asked this guy, I said, I don't feel close to God. He says, you're as close as you ever been. God's inside, become aware of it. Where did he come from? I've needed people like that all the time because my self-deception is always rooted in me. People say, you can fool others, but you can't fool yourself. Not in AA, I can fool myself all day long. I don't know where they came up with that. That's one of the broken bubbles, you know. And Bill later said that the deceptions of other people is always rooted in the deception of me. See, I have a mind that lies to me, no problem, till I believe it. It can say, hey, you can have a drink tonight. No problem at all till I believe it. As long as I say locked and loaded in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a reprieve. Okay, I'm not going to drink even if I want to. I'm been restored to sanity. It's not a process of restoring. I have been restored. I see the truth. Okay, about my drinking. So when I started getting on the path of how can I become useful to Alcoholics Anonymous, okay, and then people say, well, I'll be useful to everybody that's part of this. I don't have any qualms with that, but I will tell you one thing. There's a call to duty in the big book that's one of the loudest sentences that a person could see once you see it. It says, nothing so much assures immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when others fail. So working with other people in the assisted living or where I work with teenagers, it's all fine and dandy. It's good. Makes you feel good at night. There's some satisfaction, but I don't think it's a treatment for alcoholism. And that will be always be a debate in Alcoholics Anonymous because I go back to that line at the start of the seventh chapter that nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. I've got to remember that my mission in life, if I have one, isn't the wonderful job I have, the wonderful kid I have, the wonderful wife I have, the wonderful anything I have. It's my primary purpose. And as long as my primary purpose doesn't become me and consumed by me, I'm going to be all right. So I'm a guy that doesn't have it all together. Okay. Never have. A couple years ago, I was having a fit. This went on for a while. It was more than a couple years. It's a fit of self-centeredness, so don't worry about it. You stay here, you'll have your own. Okay. And I did not want to have a kid. You know, number one, I was almost 49 years old. You know, my life's set. You know, before the economy hit, we were able to go to Hawaii, you know, we're really where we wanted to go when we wanted to go if we, you know, work permitted and all that. And, you know, in my own self-centered way, I'm like, this is going to lock me down. You know, I got freedom to go to meetings all the time. I got this, I got that, you know, and on and on and on. The broken bubble machine, okay? And so one day, my wife says she's pregnant. And, you know, I should be running up and hugging her and say, hey, honey, sit down. You know, let me get you some roses. This is the greatest thing in the world. And I felt like crying. And in my own self-centered way, I couldn't say congratulations. I was like, this is the whole root of self-centeredness. How is this going to affect me? And instead of getting immersed in the joy of the moment, I believe I got immersed in my old friend, near and dear to me, been with me all my life. It's called self-pity. And self-pity has many different disguises. It just doesn't come sitting in the corner going, poor me, poor me, poor me. It has many disguises. And really, when I uncovered the self-pity, and always you're going to find a resentment attached to it. And the resentment in itself is self-centered fear. You know, that I was afraid. I was really afraid. And you know what? There was nothing to be afraid of. It was the broken bubble machine again producing misperceptions. And from the time that the baby came out of my wife to now has been one of the most remarkable things that could happen in a person's life like mine. And not one moment has been wasted. Okay? And at the same time, I can doubt my fatherhood. I can doubt this. I can doubt that. You know, the bubble machine's full time sometimes, and it's okay. But that is one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen when I wake up and that little old baby gets out of bed and I think, oh my God, I could have missed this because of my own self-centeredness. A few years ago, I started another business and I didn't know the economy was going to go south. I might have had second thoughts about it, and right in the midst of it, everything went south. And I tell you, for 6 months, I didn't sleep right. Scared to death. Prayed every day. That's when I upped. I'm a guy that when I was 10 years sober, I went to 3 or 4 meetings a week. I thought that was enough. When I was 15 years sober, I went to 4 or 5 meetings. No, thought that was enough. When I was 20 years sober, I made 5 to 7 meetings a week. I found that for me is just enough. I don't know what yours is. For me, that works real well. Because every time it takes me out of me just a little bit, just long enough to kind of readjust to what's going on. It's a nice break from the world. It's a good place to give myself. So I knew for sure that this thing was going to go south. I knew it. I would have told you to your face, it's going to go down. It's going. And couldn't sleep. I got my blood pressure taken. It was sky high, where before it was at least halfway normal. The fear was eating me up inside. Did an inventory on it, maybe two. Still the fear was there. And sometimes it just, for me, takes a while for the fear while I'm applying the actions to work itself out of my system. It's not like a lightning bolt. Now you've done the actions, it's gone. Hadn't happened like that for me. Usually it takes a period of adjustments, and then all of a sudden something happens. So I call my sponsor. I ask him what I need to do. He says, you need to go to work earlier, stay later, and be the best employee you can and find every avenue you can give. That's why I need a sponsor. The bubble machine wasn't working. one big bubble of fear of what will happen to me. And then he said, why don't you up your meetings and work with more newcomers? How about a loan? Yeah, that would be a spiritual awakening, a loan. Well, about a year later, one of the big competitions in my business, and wasn't too far for us, I went out of business. And another one went out of business. 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 We weren't out of business. I kept going early, staying a little bit late, going to more meetings, helping more drunks. Stayed in business. Go figure. It goes against everything the bubble machine would say. Take the actions. Watch what happens. The thinking will change. I'm not saying that I'm not afraid, but my blood pressure is good again. I sleep at night for the last several years. You know, I don't say from time to time I don't have a doubt with what's coming next. But I do that. I became a better employee and a more efficient employee in those times. Because I really do believe if we take care of our primary purpose and we treat other people with kindness, God will intervene in my problems and take care of it somehow, someday, some way. I really believe that. That has been my experience since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had a lot of those. A lot of those. You know, I just keep doing this thing. And sometimes my mind, you know, gets to the conclusion, you know, is there anything else? You know, haven't you been here long enough? And there was a point that I think was very dangerous in my sobriety. And it was probably about year 10, especially to about year 15, where I really had become such a big book Nazi, a big book thumper, which today is very distasteful to me, those two terminologies, that I had somewhat alienated myself because I didn't think the fellowship was doing it right, and there's certain meetings I couldn't sit in because they weren't my cup of tea. Again, the bubble machine. And I'm really glad I have the sponsor I've had because he kept giving me a message of acceptance in many different ways. And he told me, when you're angry at a meeting, you need to go back to the meeting until you're not angry anymore. It saved my bacon. He said, the person that you don't like in the meeting, sit next to him. Shake their hand when you come in. Well, I want you in a meeting to listen to that value that goes in. That in every AA meeting, there is a golden nugget that's dropped. and I want you to hear the golden nugget drop. And you only have one purpose when you go to a meeting anyhow. It's not to straighten anybody out. It's to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's it. That's your purpose when you go to a meeting. If it's to straighten people out, you're going to be unhappy. They're going to be unhappy. You're going to walk out the door by yourself. So when I finally got that into me, and I was able to go to those meetings, the judgment machine cut off. And today I find myself going to meetings all over the East Coast, all sorts of different types of meetings. Sometimes they don't even talk about Alcoholics Anonymous in them. And I'm listening for the golden nugget to drop. I went to a meeting in Fredericksburg about 3 months ago, and I don't usually go to men's meetings. I'm a guy that was taught, and if you go to one in a woman's meeting, fine with me. I'm not here to make a pitch against it. For me, I was taught to sit with everybody. Men, women, gays, black, white, Chinese, whoever, that we have a unity, a common problem, you know, common problem and a common solution. I also have good friends that are involved in men's stags and everything else, and I know women that go to women groups and do just fine, so I'm not here to make a pitch against that. But I ended up going to men's group for the first time that I can remember my sobriety, at least in 20 years. And the whole meeting was on step 9, and everybody talked about their anger towards their wife, their anger towards their job, their anger towards this, anger, 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 anger. And there was some steps about the amends and anger and anger and anger and anger and anger. And this anger, and I'm resentful, and bang, boom, boom. And you know when they finished? They normalized me and validated things that go on in my head. And that's what I found in AA that's been tremendous value to the broken bubble machine, is you've normalized it. It's not a weird place to live anymore. It's an alcoholic place to live, and we all live there if we're alcoholic and start to recover from this illness. We become aware of the bubbles. And the funny thing about the bubbles is we all have similar bubbles. They're not as different as what we used to think they were. And I remember Bob, my first sponsor, he always normalized my perception. He always normalized what I was feeling. He always normalized what I was going through. I'd say, Bill, Bob, I'm so angry, I'm so resentful, will it ever leave? He said, for some people, it never does, Al. I never felt like a misfit when I was talking to these guys that sponsored me. They normalized me, and that's a great value, because not only do I feel like I fit into Alcoholics Anonymous, I also feel like I fit into the world around me. Okay? And that's a great gift, because I never felt like I fit in, ever. And now I feel like I fit in. Wherever I go, I don't have a sense of inadequacy. I tell you, I am not always the most social guy. There's certainly parts of me that are antisocial. I'd rather sit alone. I'd rather read. Shaking hands gets old to me, but I do it. Okay? I do like people. I do like engaging. I also like disengaging and being quiet. Okay? But I know that there are parts of me that are still a little antisocial, you know. I'd rather be on my mountain bike going through the woods than sitting in a group of people sometimes. Well, you know, sometimes I don't have a conversation when we're talking. If you're not into the Washington Redskins, I don't know what to say. I mean, you said Dallas? No! So I'm going to leave you with a couple ideas, and then I'm going to look at something in my book if I brought it up here. It's close. Maybe. Thank you. I forgot everything tonight. But, you know, God, I believe. Okay? And if you haven't quite got the value of God yet, if you take these steps, and that's the process of becoming aware of God, not just, and meetings too, I think help. I think together it's a process. We use the word God here on three ideas. One, it's easy to spell. It's three letters. And when we say the word, everybody knows what we're talking about. Okay? So don't find it distasteful. God could have given this message to our friends in the pulpit, but he didn't. He could have. He could place this message anywhere he wanted to. Yet he allowed them, the early Oxford group members, to have quite an impact on our steps and on our fellowship. And we had many friends in the congregation that supported us for a long time and today still do. But he did not give the message to our friends in religion. He could have given us This message to our friends in medicine. We've got a lot of good doctors. Okay, Dr. Silkworth was, they considered him one of the founders. Doctor's opinion is a fabulous, fabulous appendix. But he didn't give it to them. But he did allow them to help us. They gave us a lot of help. In fact, we got the idea of the physical allergy and obsession of the mind from our friends, our doctors. He could have given it to our friends in psychiatry, but he didn't. Okay. But he allowed them to help us. And certainly along the way, Bill Wilson found some help from some folks that were in psychiatry. And some of us believe that's when he was depressed. When he stopped visiting the psychiatrist, there's no evidence of his depression anymore, but... Whoops, the bubble machine spoke, came out of my mouth and said, shut up! Alright, but he didn't. He gave the message to a broke down stock speculator named Bill Wilson. A goof, you know, that was dying of alcoholism. And he gave the message to a broken up proctologist named Dr. Bob, who was dying of alcoholism, who was a medical doctor. And what they found in common is what they had was alcoholism. They found the chemistry existed from one alcoholic that had recovered and had a message to an alcoholic who was willing to receive a message but hadn't had one yet. That chemistry between one alcoholic to another that started in Akron has multiplied itself here today. There's a certain power in that message of one alcoholic talking to another that's not when we talk to a non-alcoholic about our steps, vice versa. And I want to end this with what Dr. Bob said. And I usually don't read, but I'm going to read for Billy's 13th anniversary. He'll remember this forever. He'll say, Al read for my anniversary. This is the end of Dr. Bob's nightmare, which is the last paragraph. And this comes from him, who was a guy that by the time he died had touched and helped 5,000 alcoholics to recover. So he was very busy at work. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails. If you go about it with one half the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you wanted to get another drink.